Does grammar matter? There's no question that grammar and violations of its long-standing rules can have real consequences in our society. We're often judged by how we speak, at work, in school, and in our social circles. But does grammar matter? Some would argue that we pay too much attention to rules that are largely based on tradition. Some would even say that our reverence for what is considered correct grammar in the English language is racist or classist. Today on the program, we'll talk with a linguist and a newspaper editor about why devotion to rules of grammar matters so much to some of us, but to others is merely pedantic, or worse. And we want to hear from you. Does a dangling participle send you over the edge? Revisiting Grammar, today on Maine Calling. First, this news. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Maybe you know someone who is a grammar nut, constantly correcting others. Maybe it's you. You're not alone. Grammar and its long-standing conventions are extremely important for some of us. It's part of a mission to preserve the rules and defend them from violation at the hands of the lazy and ill-informed. Why do we feel so strongly about these rules that were handed down to us by our grandparents and our parents and our teachers? What happens when the language evolves, allowing in strange new usages and gasp overturning accepted norms? This show is part of our ongoing series about language use today. I'm joined by Carol Semple, a reader, writer, journalist, and with a background in copy editing and an online producer for the Portland Press Herald. And Connor Quinn, adjunct assistant professor of linguistics at the University of Southern Maine. Welcome to you both. We invite your questions and comments. Email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page or to Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Carol, you, like me, work in the field of journalism, and so grammar is applied in our daily work. I can probably get away with a few violations of conventions in this program today, but you live and breathe in the written word that will be captured forever in the online record of this newspaper and all of your other works. So you have to, I'm guessing, be a bit of a grammar stickler.
Well, you know, I think that people assume that about copy editors. And even though I've done this for years, I hadn't given it much thought until you called me about this show. I know that sounds odd, but that's the way it is. And I took some time to reflect on what we do. And I am not an English teacher. I am not a stellar grammarian. I have not diagrammed a sentence since I was in high school. But what we do as copy editors is we try to adhere to journalistic standards. And by that, I mean that when we look at a story, we don't dive into the grammar. We dive into questions of accuracy, of clarity, of brevity, of fairness. Is the story properly sourced? In other words, have we informed the reader, you know, who's telling us the story? There are legal issues, there are tone. But in order to achieve those things, grammar is one of our tools, and it's one of our biggest tools, especially when you come to clarity. So I think that the importance of grammar does lie in its use as a tool and not as an end in itself.
So you're not there to enforce the rules, you're there to use the rules to make sure that the reporter, the writer, is understood.
Exactly. And it, when you break it down like that, it becomes a much less, I don't want to say the word rigorous, but you're not just in the weeds all the time trying to figure out, you know, should I use this word or should I use that construction. You're really looking at the big picture and saying, what does this sentence say? And is this what we mean for this sentence to say? And grammar comes into that.
Yeah. Connor Quinn, so many of us are in the weeds. We love to wallow around in the weeds and call people out. Why is this, do you think? Why does grammar, I guess, quote unquote, matter in this way to us? Is it part of our tribalism, our tribalistic tendencies, our identity? Is it driven into us by our parents?
Well, just like Carol, I'll preface this by saying that my area of expertise in linguistics is really very much gets involved in this. Is to the side of this. All of these issues that we're talking with today all fall under the purview of sociolinguistics, as you imagine, the intersection of language and society, about which I am no expert, to say the least. But from what I've learned from fellow linguists who are expert sociolinguists and general linguistic training, and also just the kinds of work that I do, I would say that one of the things about language is it is a marker of identity. It's a marker of who you want everyone to see that you are with. So exactly how you talk and also exactly how you write reflects at least sort of where you come from and then where you come from, like how your friends, your family all talk. Exactly how you talk shows that you're part of that group, or you change how you talk to show that you want to be part of a group or feel you need to be part of a group or feel you need to follow the linguistic rules, wear the linguistic uniform that group wears. So I think one of the hardest things about grammar, which is features of how we talk, among other things, and also how we write, is that we have an incredibly emotional relationship to it, because it's about, first of all, it does very unconsciously signal who we feel affinity to, who we feel allegiance to, who we feel solidarity to. And also, and this is the key thing, from an early age, we are given very positive and very negative reactions according to the ways we talk, the kinds of grammar we use. And we watch the people around us also have very positive, very negative reactions and judgments around how other people talk. And we absorb their biases. So the same way that we learn to have biases about race and gender and class and all of that, we pick up on that in language. And particularly we pick up on any and all the finest details of how features of somebody's language might reflect an identity that we are either sort of for or against, we are taught to be for or against. Yeah. So that's the sort of starting point of it all.
Sure. I think you're making contact maybe with the microphone on your laptop or something. I'm hearing scratching noise. Just be mindful of it. Thank you. So there are schools of thought. This is emergent now, I guess, as an argument that while we have all these sort of regional dialects and they're part of our identity, maybe even the main dialect is people want to identify as, I belong to this group. But there is a sort of standard English that we sort of put at the top of this pyramid that we use as the standard for, getting into college, being in the professional workplace. That's sort of, I guess, the typical English grammar rules that we're all familiar with from early age. Some would argue that by placing such emphasis on that and devaluing maybe these other ethnic or regional or class ways of speaking, that's essentially racist or classist in and of itself. How big of a movement is this within not only just academics, but within the realm that you're familiar with?
Well, within my field, all of that is basically a given, that the dialect of English, the variant of English that we've been told is sort of the one true correct one, the standard, or at least a practical standard, or the thing that sort of brings us together kind of standard, can certainly carries out those functions, but it's also the privileged dialect. It is the dialect that if you speak it, all doors open for you. And if you don't speak it, or to the degree that you, the way you talk, diverges from the standards of the norms of that dialect, you get punished. You get punished. You get not thought of as equally intelligent. You get thought of as not as educated. You get thought of as not serious, not respectful, a whole array of things. You get punished for talking simply how the other people you grew up with or talk. And that's the problem. So there's sort of two, and then in our field in linguistics, from like linguistics 101, the first thing we teach people is that there's no scientific basis to why this dialect or that dialect would somehow be better, more logical, better at expressing things, all of that. There's just simply no way to back that up in scientific fact. What we learn in sociolinguistics 101 is that societies decide to put value on these sort of arbitrary features of this dialect versus that dialect. And usually what it is the dialect that happens to be spoken by the elite, by the people and powerful, is, surprise, the best dialect and the one we should all aspire to. And most importantly, the one we kind of end up or should make or use as the standard. And so the problem is mostly on what does that do to people who don't meet that standard for any number of reasons. Why do we think it's okay to treat them badly, not hire them, et cetera? And in particular, I think at a personal level, we have to think about why do we have such a strong negative gut reaction to like some of the ways that either those people from that group talk or those young people talk and so forth. Why do we have that strong emotional reaction, which then makes us kind of try to rationalize why those people are talking wrong and there's something wrong with them.
So in our field, that's a given.
Yeah, the movement, I think, is starting to sort of come, like word is getting outside of linguistics, starting to spread to other parts of academia and other parts of the world, of society. But it's been slow going, needless to say.
So how would you, Carolyn, how would you apply this idea that we're holding up what we consider the standard English, the rules of standard English, that's a nefarious thing, and that we should accommodate maybe more different kinds of usages? How in the practical world might you be able to do that, say, at a newspaper? I mean, aren't you sort of beholden to stick to more conventional grammatic rules?
Well, we do, because we have to write so that people will understand that in the broad scheme of things, people will understand what we're saying. But I'd like to distinguish here between spoken language and written language, because I think from my observations in the pluralistic society that we live in, is we give a lot more latitude to spoken language. And I think Connor pointed out, you know, we're raised to speak a certain way. And for instance, I was raised in a raucous Italian neighborhood. And when I go back to that neighborhood, I do not speak the same way I spoke when I went to college. You know, you adapt, you look at the group around you and you can adapt to them. But I don't think one way of speaking is better than another, as long as you are understood. When it comes to writing, the problem is that it must be understood beyond the group that you find yourself in at the moment. And that's the challenge. And the nice thing about, the good thing about living in this time is that we can be less rigid. We have the opportunities to stand back and look more at our use of language and be more reflective about what it says and what it does. And as an example, I mean, you know, the Associated Press style book has existed for longer than I've been in newsrooms, but you can find it online now. And there is an ongoing AP style book, because people are raising these questions. How do we say this and be fair to a certain group? You know, is it right to call, to refer to this group as such and such? And so in real time, we can now assess these things and change them up and you know, keep up and try to be relevant to as many people as possible.
One of the recent examples is this, the shift in gender pronouns and the evolution of assigning the word they to one person who identifies neither specifically as female or male. How has that landed in the Press Herald's style book?
Well, it's not a difficult lift for us. At least I don't think it has been, because the way we have dealt with it is, if an individual expresses to us that they use they, them, we simply use that on the second reference to the person. And then we just insert a sentence that says this person uses the they, them pronoun. And the reason we insert the sentence is to signal that it's not a grammatical error. So it actually is not difficult to change language and to have it be understood by a lot of people. And on the subject of they, them, I noticed a sign in my doctor's office the other day that said, if you would like a chaperone to be in the examining room, talk to a staff member and they will help you. So this usage is not foreign to us. We have, in our casual language, we have accepted the use of they, them when referring to an individual. And there's this wonderful piece I would recommend to anybody, written by, I think she is a Yale writing professor, maybe. Her name is Anne Fadiman, and she wrote this terrific piece in Harper's. And Connor's nodding. She wrote this terrific piece in Harper's in April 2020. And it happened to come out at a time when I was trying to wrap my head around this and said, oh, no, they, them is plural. How do we deal with this? And I hate to be the spoiler alert for this wonderful essay she wrote, but she describes her eureka moment when she hits upon the words you are. We use you are both singular and plural. That's how we use it. If you have your teenage daughter and her friends are in their house, they're in your house and they're announcing they're going to a concert, you might say to the friends, oh, so you are going to a concert, meaning the group. And you may look at your daughter and say, you are not going to the concert. So you've used a singular and a plural, and you've used the same verb. So it's really not that foreign to us as it seems at first glance.
So there's precedent already in the language.
There is.
We just choose not to accept it, or it's strange to our ears, so it's uncomfortable, and we reject it as a violation of rule.
Exactly.
Yeah. Connor, is this an example, though, that language then, our language, English language, does change? It does, albeit slowly, but it does acknowledge these changes and can bring them in?
Well, one thing I've learned in 20 plus 25 years, I guess, of linguistics is there's basically no such thing as languages or language as a thing. We are constantly constituting and reconstituting what we think of as language ourselves. So there is no English language out there. There's only what we're doing. There's what people have done in the past and what we're doing now. And that's all there is. That's all there is and ever will be. And since that's the case, it's always changing and it's never been stable and it's never been fixed. And there's a natural tendency among in speech and in writing to want to harmonize and kind of mostly follow the same rules, as if we're all playing a game that can have some local variations, but we'll have, at any given point, the main rules of the game are the same for pretty much everybody. And that's kind of how communities of speakers, speech communities, both locally and like radically international speech communities composed of upwards of billions of people, they're all kindly, always basically accommodating each other to one degree or another. And that's what keeps languages coherent. Where you get the problem is where people suddenly say, my particular rules or my group's particular rules are the ones that everyone has to follow. And I'm going to make up some really poorly argued reasons as to why our rules are the only logical ones and your rules are foolish and illogical. And again, it's mostly the association of social and political and economic power with the group that talks that way that actually gives any heft behind that assertion that our way to do it is and always has been the only right way to talk, and it should never change. It will change. It's always changing. It's constantly changing. And usually the degree to which it changes people often react like, I can't understand how those people talk. Well, sometimes, but usually about half of the problem is you have a really strong emotional reaction to one or two of the ways that people talk, or a whole array of them. And then that makes you basically unwilling to try to accommodate. Because of course, people can have very strongly different accents from really far ends of the English spectrum. But most of the time, if people are just willing to talk to each other and take those accents for granted, then they'll be able to accommodate and that'll be just fine. That again is in speech. What Carol said about writing is, it's a little bit more tricky to accommodate. You're not doing it in real time. Someone's reading it after the fact. But even there's always a lot of room for accommodation. Like obviously I can read writing written in other dialects of English to one degree or another. And it just is a question of like, am I willing? Why am I willing? Which dialects are more familiar with so that I'm comfortable with that already versus ones I'm less comfortable with? How much more work am I going to have to do to accommodate them? It's a very different view. Yeah.
And if purists,
can I ask you a question? Oops, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was going to say, go ahead. And then we have to take a quick break, but go ahead with your question. Yeah, Carol.
I just wanted to ask Connor a quick question, which is, do you think that movies and our exposure to other vernaculars and other dialects in movies has made it much easier for us as a culture now to not feel that otherness when we encounter another group?
Yeah, I think it's really helped quite a bit. I can even see over watching about the last 25 years of Doctor Who, it has made me passively very comfortable with a lot of different British accents, UK accents. And I've also noticed in recent Doctor Who how much of US or North American usage has now, thanks to increased media, filtered into ordinary, what's portrayed at least as ordinary everyday UK usage. So things are sloshing back and forth precisely through this. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, and if the purists had their way and were successful, we'd still be speaking the language of Shakespeare, right? Which is it's evidence that the language evolves and changes.
Mm.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk more about the importance of grammar, importance in quotes there. The number is 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Kent Hill School, an independent school in central Maine, helping students in grades 9 to postgraduate year make a difference in the world. KentHill.org and New England Naturopathic Health, focused on individually oriented and minimally invasive healthcare. NaturopathicME.com.
When Native American communities protest fossil fuel pipelines, canceled projects could prevent nearly a billion tons of CO2 emissions per year.
We are making a tremendous impact. And then really, we are literally leading the way in what it takes to address climate change.
The impact of indigenous activism on climate change on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Join us this afternoon at 2, right here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public is a media sponsor of the Pacifica Quartet, presented by Portland Ovations. On Wednesday evening, October 20th, the quartet will perform works by American female composers during the ratification of the 19th Amendment, the pro-suffrage era, and today. Maine Public members are eligible for 15% off tickets to the concert. For details on the Pacifica Quartet and the Maine Public member discount, please visit mainepublic.org and click on events.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. We're talking about the role, the rules of grammar, and how we are evolving. My guests, Connor Quinn, adjunct assistant professor of linguistics at USM, and Carol Semple, a writer and online producer for the Portland Press Herald. Share your comments, questions, email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, post a comment to our Facebook page or to Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. We'll take a few calls, and I suspect we'll get, what was it that, Connor, you referred to it as earlier as grammar peeving? Yeah. These are things that we hear on the street every day or in media that for whatever reason kind of just drive us nuts. And we'll talk about what some of those are. It's interesting. I polled some of the people in my social and professional life, and they all kind of came up with some of the same ones, which is interesting, which are sort of new, evolving usages, relatively new anyway. I'm wondering, as I'm listening to the conversation here, about this idea of protecting the rules versus allowing change. Isn't it sort of a balance? That is, what we're trying to do is strike a balance so that the rules are kept in place so that at least to keep the change at a certain pace so that there's no confusion. Because if we were to allow the rules to change constantly and openly, might we not run into a situation where we lose the ability to understand each other in critical moments? And I'll ask either, but I'll go to Connor first.
I'm basically not remotely worried about that. As a linguist, when we observe different languages and different speech communities all over the world, there's always a certain degree of change. There's also always a certain degree of resistance to change. There's also, which is sort of what we're dealing with here, but even societies that don't, speech communities that don't have like people, you know, kind of cracking the whip about usage, the level of change, basically people never really change their language so far that they can't talk to the people they want to talk to and they can't be understood by the people they want to talk to. There can be misunderstandings on the spot here and there and so forth. But by and large, the kinds of things that cause misunderstanding across variations of different dialects of English is actually less about the language and more about the failure of those groups to engage socially in the first place, so that they are not familiar with how other people talk, and as a result, in some occasions, can misunderstand them. So it's the differences between language variants usually are less the issue and more people not engaging with folks directly, or and also bringing their own sense of language as like, my way is the right way. Whatever people do that's different from me is just wrong, and I should basically kind of ignore and dismiss it rather than try to understand it. It's all about a combination.
Yeah. Carol, as an editor, this is sort of, I guess, a personal question about your how you react. Sometimes, for whatever reasons, this is one of my things, when I see begs the question used to mean prompts the question or raises the question, you know, that whereas my when I learned begs the question, it had to do more with avoiding the question. It was like a forensics word or something. This always makes me uncomfortable. And yet now it's in the dictionary as being acceptable. This phrase begs the question being the same prompting or raising the question. When you're doing an edit, you don't have visceral feelings about phrases that you have to allow to be included now because the usage has changed?
I think we have a little more leeway than you do on this. Begs the question is not something that a reporter would normally put in. A columnist might. The rules governing editing a columnist are much different than the rules governing editing a story that is for general, you know, news, to convey a general news sense. So if a columnist wants to say, begs the question, then my attitude is have at it. It doesn't matter whether I'm annoyed by it or not.
I really have to let this go.
It's a little different for phrases that, I did what you did. I polled some of my colleagues before I came on here, and it was about grammar peeving. I asked them what their pet peeves were. Everybody has them. So there's no way you can edit out all of the things that are going to annoy one person or another. So you do your best.
Right. Take a deep breath and accept it. And Connor, this is a thing. We were talking before air, and we were sort of chatting about what we might discuss. And so this thing is a thing, this grammar peeving. Why is it? Why do we get so caught up?
Well, if I could shift that question a little bit, we're all familiar with it. And I think the straightforward reason why it happens is because we get taught to do it, right? We all get taught by our teachers and our parents, don't say this, you want to say may, not can, and all that kind of stuff. We get taught to do that, and some of us kind of pick up on it and internalize and so forth. But I really want to draw the focus less to the grammar peeves and more to their targets, because the real question is, who's getting hurt? Who's getting affected by grammar peeving at a, you know, kind of personal face-to-face level that's unpleasant, but grammar peeving at a, like, on behalf of an HR person who's deciding whether or not to hire somebody really makes a material difference to people's lives, and so on and so forth. So I think the big question is, how do we treat people well if they talk differently from us? How do we learn, how do we look at ourselves at when the basically the grammar peeve gut reaction, and I'm going to extend that to everything, to like when people have a gut gnat reaction of like against up talk or vocal fry and all those types of things. What's our responsibility to the other person when we have that gut reaction, right? In the same way, if we are, say, teachers of children or teachers of college students who come with non-standard, non-privileged ways of talking, or even stigmatized, as we say in linguistics, stigmatized ways of talking, which is more people than not. How do we treat those folks? How do we change what we tell them about how to feel about how the way they talk? Because we all have to be very linguistically flexible in this complicated world where people have lots of different linguistic backgrounds. The big difference is whether or not we say, well, standard language, as we call it, the privileged dialect, has certain uses. Also, it's still basically unavoidable that you're going to get discriminated against if you don't follow it. There's a big difference between helping people who are willing and interested and understand it, do this with consent, to learn to use standard, what's called the standard language, in order to pass, in order to not be discriminated against, in order to survive, versus telling them that the fact that you don't already speak this, or any point when you fail to meet this standard, means there's something wrong with you. There's a big difference between, this is an arbitrary thing that's been forced on you and all of us, essentially, so here's what you got to do to survive, versus you are somehow deficient because you didn't already come with this. Like for me, I've talked this way my whole life. This is basically the privileged standard dialect, and it was just handed to me for free. That is absolutely, I had to do no work to get all of the privileges that come with this. Tons of other people have to do an enormous amount of work to this. Even both of my parents, they did not grow up speaking this way, and they had to work real hard to come to speak this way, so that they weren't discriminated, especially in their work environments.
So you may think you're doing a favor to someone when you correct them, but you're saying you're not.
Well, I think we just need to be really clear about the difference between, to one degree or another, we're at least currently stuck with the social institution of a privileged dialect that we call the standard, and a long history of really treating people very badly for failing to follow it. We need to be really aware of that. And so when we talk about, like, I'm a linguist, and tons of people are always afraid that I'm going to judge them for their language or come down on them for their language. When in fact, our job in our world, if we're doing any good as a linguist, is to help people be finally secure in how you speak. Whatever way you started to speak is fine. And whatever way these sort of dysfunctional and basically elitist societal norms about how you're supposed to speak are imposed on you, we're here to sort of help you know, well, do what you got to do to survive that. We'll even help you do what you got to do to survive that. But we are here to tell you that you never should have had to do this in the first place, that there's nothing wrong with you in the way you talk.
Let's go to the phones now. We'll bring in Marty in Portland. Hi, Marty. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. What a fascinating show. I'm a... Oh, by the way, there's a great site, etymologyonline.com. I think that's...
Ooh, love it.
Anyway.
Love it.
Also, I heard a reference earlier about some word was in the dictionary. So my question is the dictionary prescriptive or proscriptive? Does it define what things should be, or is it a relation of historical usages? And from what I've experienced, it's more proscript, describes common usage rather than this is what it's supposed to be. So I'd just love to hear your viewpoints on that. Thanks.
Yeah. Marty, thank you. Carol?
Well, I think the dictionary is also evolving. When I polled my colleagues about grammar peeves, one of the words that came up was impact. The use of impact as a verb when you mean something other than hitting things. And it's everywhere. We use it in the paper all the time. And it drives some copy editors completely bonkers because more than one of them mentioned it to me. So I went to the dictionary and I looked up impact. And the dictionary noted that in common usage now, impact has come to mean effect. And it made note that a lot of people object to this, which I found surprising because I don't think I've ever seen that in the dictionary before. So I think that even the dictionary is beginning to acknowledge that some words, you know, come into common usage or that some words might have a different effect on people.
I was always curious also about when we violate the sort of rules of other languages in our own language. And I'm drawn to this is a word that comes up a lot in our work, which is data. And so I took Latin, and to me it's a plural, but you know, now we're hearing very commonly the data shows X, and this makes my, you know, neck hair stand on end. I know it shouldn't, but it does. What would you say, Connor, about that? Is that in the same realm? We just allow change in usage to happen and then accept it?
I think the basic answer is yes, because that's what language does. That's what speakers of languages do. Words come in, they get used, redefined, reused. If we tried to use all the words in English that are of French or Latin origin according to their original meanings, none of us would know half of the words we're currently using. They've all shifted in meaning and function in all kinds of ways. So the fact that data is now taken as a singular and kind of a mass noun rather than the sort of etymological plural of datum, that it was thing given. In the original Latin is really fine. And in fact, I think one of the fun things about English is you can actually use it as either a singular or a plural and give it a slightly different nuance. And when I say you can, I mean, people find it that it makes sense to them. It's not like a rule that you can.
Go ahead. I'm going to take a quick break and we come back and we'll continue your thought. The number 1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. We'll take another quick break. When we come back, more of your questions and comments. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the UMaine Alumni Association, inviting you to learn how Black Bear alumni are helping shape Maine's economy at umainealumni.com/impact. And Cape Integrative Health, committed to working with Medicare patients to treat chronic lower back pain with acupuncture. Learn more at capeintegrativehealth.com.
I'm Scott Tong. It is the most streamed show ever. Squid Game is Netflix's latest and biggest hit, a dystopian game of life and death, and a harsh commentary on modern capitalism.
Every person standing here in this room is living on the brink of financial ruin.
That's next time on Here and Now.
지금 이 자리에 계신 여러분들은 모두 감당할 수 없는 빚을 지고.
Join us for Here and Now. That's coming up today at noon, right here on Maine Public Radio. We invite you to join us for Maine Public's Stash of Maine Masterpiece Cooking Challenge. Do you have a favorite recipe that everyone loves? Send it to us along with a picture of the completed dish to enter the challenge. But that's not all. We want to know which Masterpiece character you've made the dish for and why. Maybe a favorite rum cake for Inspector Morse to lighten him up a bit, or a beans and Frank's casserole for Lady Mary so she can see how the other half lives. We'll pick two winners each week. Visit mainepublic.org for all the details.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Our topic today is grammar. We're discussing the importance of grammar and its relevance today. Joining me, Carol Semple, writer and editor with the Portland Press Herald, and Connor Quinn. He teaches linguistics at USM. Join the conversation, the number 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page or to Instagram. Connor, I rudely interrupted you prior to the break, but you can, if you remember your thought,
It was just apropos of things coming from other languages. I think one of the things that's instructive about the arbitrariness of the kinds of grammar rules we've been taught is if you compare double negatives in English, in standard privileged dialect English versus standard privileged dialect French. In plenty of dialects of English, it's very natural to say, I don't believe nobody, right? And that's considered, that's stigmatized, it's considered basically wrong. People make arguments that two negatives contradict each other, et cetera, right? The whole shebang. Meanwhile, in French, je ne crois, how do you say, I forget. Well, je ne crois rien, I don't believe anything, but literally means I don't believe nothing. Or even just say, French basically, a standard French always requires a double negative, like je ne sais pas, right? Ne, and then another pas to negative it out. And je ne crois, how do you say nobody? Quelqu'un, I guess. Standard French requires and demands a double negative. Standard English requires and demands that you don't do a double negative. Colloquial English, lots of dialects do double negatives all the time. And then colloquial French does a single negative, which is then considered not correct. So it highlights that like all of these possibilities are just things you can do with language. And it's basically an artifact of history that the elite speakers of English went with a single negative and then sort of said, everything else but that is wrong. And the elite speakers of French went with a double negative and said doing a single negative is wrong. So obviously none of this is wrong. It's all just various ways you can do language.
Let's have Frank weigh in on this. Frank is joining us now from Southwest Harbor. Hi, Frank. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call. What your speaker just said, that none of this is wrong, to me is, I'm an English teacher, is complete nonsense. To say Bobby ain't seen nobody today, well, it means if he hasn't seen nobody, he has seen somebody. So the double negatives, to say, well, French does it, English doesn't, we don't speak French, we speak English. And it's nonsense to say accept everything because certain groups use that. Change the groups around and have them speak correctly. The other two things I want to raise are, and this is among, with a group of college professors recently, and somebody said, well, the general consensus of opinion is this, and my skin literally crawls. Consensus means a majority opinion, as you know, a general agreement, so consensus. Nobody needs to say general consensus or, even worse, general consensus of opinion. I hate that. Get rid of it. Consensus means consensus. And the other thing is, and it seems to be younger people doing this, high school kids, grammar school kids, me and Alvin, we're going to the movie tonight. Wait a minute. Me and Alvin are going? Do you always think of yourself first? Would you say, me are going to the movie? Of course you wouldn't. I'm going to the movie. So why isn't it Alvin and I are doing something today? Yeah. Those are my three things.
All right,
consensus,
Frank.
Double negatives, and don't put me first when you're doing something with somebody else. That's terrible.
Yeah, Frank, thanks so much. So Frank, I think, is voicing some standard grammar peeves. We hear this a lot, particularly the me and Billy Carol, and he also, I think, embodies the kind of irritation level that we have when we suggest that maybe we could relax this a little bit. Do you hear this sort of thing? I guess my question is Frank is not alone. He voices a pretty common opinion.
I think it's safe to say that for anybody who cares about language, there are usages or constructions that to their ear sound like fingernails on a blackboard. I think we all have them. I mean, yes, there is right usage and wrong usage. The issue I always come down to is the audience. In the case of the teenagers, it's cool probably to speak this way among their group. I think the challenge for educators is to make sure that, and this speaks to what Connor was saying about, you know, you have to at some point deal with a PR department. I mean, you know, your department at your office where you want to apply for a job. You have to at some point deal with people who have an expectation for certain type of language usage. But I think it can easily be taught that it's okay for you to speak this way to your friends, but when you sit down to write a letter and you want to get this job, you have to behave a certain way. I was very amused when one of my sons graduated from college. They did a session. They did it with athletes. And what they did is they got them all together and they brought them into a very formal dinner. And they taught them, which spoon do you use, you know, first here? And it's because the college happened to be training a lot of people who would be going into the diplomatic corps. So they wanted to make sure that they could fit in no matter where. And I think I was very amused by this. I thought it was quite wonderful and funny. I think you can do the same thing with language. You can say to people, and I think Connor's probably going to disagree with me, that when you want to express yourself to A, B, C, or D, you maybe need to follow some of the grammar rules so that you don't send somebody's, as Frank said, puts his hair on end, you know?
Yeah. I want to let Connor respond to Frank, too, since it was directed, the criticism was of him. So go ahead.
Well, I would also like to respond to Carol in that I both agree and disagree, in the sense that I agree on the one hand that for people to be able to survive the linguistic environment, the linguistic environment of our social and economic system, it is definitely useful, helpful, or even crucial to be able to pass and to be able to meet the standards of people, the linguistic standards of people who have power, important kinds of power over you, just to survive. And so I don't think any of us are ever advocating that we just don't let kids learn how to survive or do what they need to do. I think we're clear on that point, and we're all in agreement on that point. However, I think we also think change needs to happen, that these things that kids and various people speaking stigmatized dialects are having to accommodate in order to survive, there's always going to be a certain degree of accommodation between this group and that group, and that's fine. But a lot of the things that people are being forced to accommodate for, or more precisely, a lot of the punishments they're getting for, you know, still speaking with their particular vowels or still speaking with their particular grammar ending and so forth, are absolutely unwarranted. And that's the change we need to start making. And that's the change that we can all make in our minds, that we can start interrogating, questioning our grammar peeps and saying, how much of that is a question of like, oh, what they said was illogical and completely unintelligible versus, oh, I've just been raised to think that and have a real strong gut reaction to that. So I think accommodation is always a natural, and from both sides of the conversation, is a natural part of how language works. And I think the issue with grammar peeving is actually it's a failure to accommodate on one side, and the side that has power basically and says, and a demand from that side that the other side accommodate completely. I think we in a more equitable, as we work towards a more equitable society, we can see the difference between, all right, let's try to keep here. We're going to work towards a sort of a common standard, but distinguish that, for example, from, let me put it this way. A common standard always is always in flux and always emerging and always pretty workable. That's how it works with human languages. The big issue is do we tell people they are bad, that they are deficient for not talking the way we currently think you should talk? Right. And in particular, do we immediately, instantly gut bias ourselves against those people when they speak with uptalk or they use some of the things that they have some of the usages that Frank worked with? And I want to make one quick point about all this, is that part of the problem is we conflate following all these particular rules that are called the rules of language, which they really aren't. They're the rules of a particular privileged dialect of language. They don't just exist objectively. Following the rules of all that stuff versus more related, but really separate, really separate issue of, however you use language, there are often, you know, very effective and very ineffective ways of organizing your thoughts, presenting your thoughts, and a lot of that does have to do with your choice of words and grammar and so forth, especially with regard to your audience, as Carol has pointed up, is really the most important thing. But basically, good rhetoric, good linguistic organization, good choice of how you're going to present your thoughts is actually pretty independent. It is a separate issue even from which exact grammar rules are you going to, which vowels are you going to use to speak with, which grammatical endings are. They're not totally separate. Like, you kind of have to deploy your rhetoric through through a particular way of talking, your home way, your family way, the privileged dialects way, and so forth. But at the end of the day, we usually teach good grammar as both of those things, as the privileged dialects way of doing anything, and basically composition and organization of thoughts and presentation of thoughts through language. But they're really not the same. The standard privileged dialect and good language and effective ways to present through language are not actually the same thing.
All right, we've got 2 minutes left. I want to bring in Paul, who's calling from Lewiston. Hi, Paul, real quickly, if you could, please.
Yeah, I drive the Safe Ride Shuttle at Bates College here in Lewiston, and I hear a lot of conversation. And like is a word that is so constantly used, I think it takes up half the words that are used in any conversation. Yeah. So I once asked a pre-law student, I said, Kyle, do you think you could separate this conversational DNA with the word like that you have from, say, speaking in a courtroom in the future? And he said, I think so. I said, but do you know? And he really wasn't sure. And I wonder what people feel about, what the panel feels about this use of the word like in 50. It seems like 50% of the word is used in any conversation.
Yeah. Carol, if you could do that in like 20 seconds or less.
I think that when I hear the word like, it is often from very young people. And that as people get older and they go into, say, the courtroom, if that's their job, that they quickly learn to use other words.
Okay. Connor?
I was trying to remember the name of the author of this, linguist who's done an extraordinarily in-depth analysis of the use of the umpteen uses of like, including all the ones that peeve people. It's really very important, and it's a major part it serves a lot of functions that maybe people who don't use it as much are not aware of. So, so here again, I think the main issue is people who use a lot of like can of course learn to dial it back and accommodate people who really don't like it. But I think the people who really don't like it need to ask themselves, what am I missing? What am I not understanding in how they're using like? Maybe I should pay more attention to like, what are they conveying when they use like, instead of assuming that it's meaningless. It's absolutely not meaningless. It has discourse functions. It organizes how people present and explain information and frame information, especially as addressed to the person they're talking to. It's actually all about the other person, how I'm representing my information to you.
And that's so got to be the last word.
Not about linguistic laziness or anything like that.
Sorry, Connor. We're out of time. Appreciate it. I'm sure there are tons of people who want to get on this conversation. We're not going to be able to do that. But thank you both for joining us today. Carol Sample is a writer and journalist with a background in copy editing and an online producer for the Portland Press Herald. Connor Quinn is an adjunct assistant professor of linguistics at the University of Southern Maine. Today's sound engineer was KG Akin-Miladun. This program will be rebroadcast tonight at 7. Our theme song was composed by Mike Jandro. Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn produce Maine Calling. Visit mainecalling.org to listen to past programs and sign up for our podcast. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.